On today's episode of Biomedical Design Stories, we're joined by Governor Deval Patrick. We'll be discussing the healthcare and life sciences ecosystem here in Massachusetts. And I'm joined by my co-host, Brian Johnson, president of MassMedic.
Thanks, Matt. Although he needs no introduction, here's a bit about our guest. Deval Patrick served as the 71st governor of Massachusetts from 2007 to 2015 and is responsible for the implementation of the Massachusetts Healthcare Reform Law as well as the Life Sciences Act of 2008. He is a senior advisor at Bain Capital and the founder and chairman of the Together Fund.
Governor Patrick, thank you so much for joining us today. We're
pleasure
grateful to have you.
Thank you. Just pointing out that this is episode 3. You just now got around to inviting me to come.
Wow. We had to build up our chops.
I see.
We had to practice. I was episode 1, so you know,
okay, like,
we're on an upward trajectory.
I had to convince Brian to do this with me first.
Do you know what I noticed about, so ex-athletes always gain weight after they play. Mm. Public servants and politicians and ex-governors and congressmen always get in much better shape after. What? You look great.
That's like, very kind.
You look great.
That's like, nice of you to that nice wind up there.
Yeah,
to the like what? The weight of office.
Is it bad food? Like, what's...
You know, I wouldn't dare say that if I was still in politics. First of all, I love to eat, and people are always handing me things.
Yeah.
They'd made things and what have you, and you want to honor that. But yeah, I'm eating a little better, although I'm late in part because I was scarfing down a half of a grilled cheese sandwich in the parking lot. Right? It's the first chance I've had to eat all day.
You did 2 terms as our governor, and then after you leave office, I mean, what's that first day like? For you?
You're a lot more tired than you think you are.
Yeah.
You know, not every day was great, but we had a lot of great days. I think we got a lot of good things done. And we certainly tried to do as much good for as many people for as long as we could. So we were driving hard the whole time, and it was energizing, but it's exhausting.
Yeah, I mean, I was there that night you made the long walk. It was cold, right?
It was really cold.
It was a really cold night.
It was a shorter long walk.
I just remember, like, when you walked down and out those stairs, I kind of felt like something really special had ended. And, like, you brought an energy to the office to almost every... Because I saw you at a ton of public appearances and... I had never seen somebody who sort of embodied the energy of the moment like you did. You were such an amazing spokesman for this Commonwealth.
Thank you.
I will never forget, like, you were at a MassMedic event, and a guy caught up and was like, I'm thinking about moving my company to Massachusetts. And you were like, let's talk afterwards. And you actually went up and talked to the guy. And I just felt like that was your administration in a nutshell, was like you were here to sell the state.
Well, thank you. There's a lot to sell. It's a really special place, and it has the complexities of many, many other places, and some that are unique. One thing I will say that I discovered as a first-time candidate and in the way that we ran the campaign, it was very close to people. It was very grassroots, and we talked to everybody, the ones who we thought might agree and the ones who we thought might not, and everybody in between, whatever party or no party, and all over the state. And Matt, you'll know what I mean when I say that in the Berkshires, folks feel like Beacon Hill is just about Beacon Hill. Turns out they feel that way in Worcester County. They feel that way in Merrimack Valley. They feel that way in the South Coast. They feel that way in Roxbury. And that notion that the dynamic here is not so much Democrat-Republican as it is insider-outsider, that's a big deal to all of us here in Massachusetts. Most people who are not in politics in Massachusetts, I think that's becoming a bigger deal in how I think about national politics as well. So the great power of the job was the convening power, meaning you could get, you know, it was great to get important legislation moved and executive actions and what have you, but the you could get anybody to come to your conference table, and you could get them to come and sit with people they didn't normally talk to. And that kind of collaborative problem solving was a pretty exciting exciting thing. And I think that that was the sort of contribution we were trying to bring, Brian.
Yeah. You started your campaign like 2 years before the election or something.
Can you bear it? I went to see an old friend of mine who had just been elected to the United States Senate, really just minutes before I decided to run, named Barack Obama. And we were sitting in his office in the basement of whatever that office building was. And I had helped in the campaign, his campaign. And I said, Barack, I got an idea. I just want to tell you, I'm going to run for governor. And he said, He said, you got any money? I said, nope. He said, you got any people? I said, nope. He said, what's your name recognition? I said, 2% on the days we're bragging, probably 1%. His response was, I'm in. But that was true. We had none of that. Yeah. We were gonna build it, and it was entirely possible that it couldn't have been built. I wasn't all that interested in what I think Democrats often focus on, which is how to win. I wanted to talk about why we should, and I got good people around me who could manage the how.
I'd like to start with a discussion about your experiences with healthcare and how they've informed both your policy and your future vision. You tell a great story in your memoir about growing up in the South Side of Chicago, and when you were born in your grandmother's bed.
Right.
And she wrapped you in a blanket and put you in an open oven to keep you warm.
So I am told. It makes absolutely no sense, because this was the middle of the summer, but there you are.
These were different times, certainly, but I just wanted to start with what your experience was like with healthcare as a child growing up.
I don't remember, probably blessedly, having a lot of experience with healthcare. I mean, I didn't have broken bones or anything like that. There was a hospital in Hyde Park. I think it was called the Osteopathic Hospital. It was associated with the university, and it was a short bus ride or a long walk from where we lived, and they had a free clinic. And we went there every once in a while, my sister and me, with my mother for checkups or the immunizations that we needed for school. Although I will say a lot of the vaccinations and immunizations they gave in the school at that time. I remember that we got our dental care from a free clinic associated with Northwestern. That was on the north side, and that was a long ride. And there was this, think of a gym, just a vast gym, and all these dental chairs and students and children screaming bloody murder and instructors pointing out what not to pull. And I mean, I actually heard an instructor say to a dentist in training, Not that one. but we both really needed braces, and they had a program there where they could do a modified charge for braces, and my mother could swing one of those fees, not both of them. So my sister has brilliant, beautiful teeth, and mine are all over the place. I remember that. I remember once... I don't know that I've ever talked about this publicly, but I was a little kid and distracted or bored or something like that, but I ended up with orange seeds down my ears, and I couldn't get them out. And my mother, after yelling, all kinds of inappropriate, not appropriate for this broadcast or for children kind of thing, took me to the emergency room at Cook County. Actually, I take that back. That was the third stop. The first was a doctor who lived, and this is segregated Chicago, right? So there were all sorts of people in the neighborhood. A black doctor who lived a couple blocks away, who didn't have the equipment to reach down, because I wouldn't be still. I was terrified. And then over to osteopathic, where they were going to have to admit me, and so they said, and charge some money my mother didn't have. And so we ended up in the emergency room at County Hospital, at Cook County Hospital, which is an infamous place. And I'll never forget lying on this gurney while they taped me down. They taped, it was fabric tape that went around my head and around the gurney and around, because I wouldn't be still. I was so afraid. My mother was hysterical too. And without anesthesia or anything, they pulled these orange seeds out. So those are some experiences with the healthcare system that I remember. Sort of catch as catch can, really.
Can you look back and see any sort of through lines that may have influenced you into how you thought about the world of healthcare?
Well, I will say that I think that there are a lot of people who don't seek care they need and could use, not just preventative care, but responsive care, because they are just as then afraid of the cost or afraid of the access or afraid of the experience. My mother had a condition called lupus. It was a discoid kind that it attacks your skin rather than the kind that affects your internal organs. And she saw a dermatologist, I think early, who basically said, you know, rub some Vaseline on it or something like that. And she ended up with all these, all this scarification, and really affected her self-confidence. And it has, there are all kinds of other issues beyond the medical ones. I think had she, you know, had a relationship with a primary care physician, had she had a place she could go where they would understand her and appreciate all that was involved in having this really stunningly beautiful woman now have her face covered with scars, the sort of things that little kids would point at and turn away from and so forth, it might have been different.
Yeah, I mean, I think that kind of brings us to this question of healthcare during the pandemic and how this is really been a mirror on the healthcare system at large. Mm-hmm. What can this moment now teach us about the universalizing the quality of care?
Well, I think on the upside, the movement toward universal care has been growing for some while, and the steps that my predecessor took alongside Ted Kennedy and the Democratic leadership in the state Senate and the state House were, you know, really big and important steps, compromises that got us to near universal coverage. I think that and then along came the ACA, so-called Obamacare, and that brought some additional dimensions and some additional resources. The one thing missing, in my view, was the public option. Because I do think there was some value in having that competition alongside the private sector to cause the private sector to sort of step up its game, and frankly, to cause Medicare to step up its, if Medicare were, for example, the public option. But I think that there are parts of this journey that we don't really talk very much about. One gets to the question of cultural competence, the readiness of the industry, if that's the right thing, or the professions, the health-related professions, to actually provide care, not just an appointment, but real care and whole person care for people. And I think you do have to have a certain amount of cultural sensitivity to be able to do that well, no matter what the culture. And then the second thing is, we haven't really dealt with the fact that if we were to flip a switch, let me put it this way, and go to universal today, I'm not talking about by law, but actually everyone is supposed to have access to a doctor. We don't have capacity. There are not enough primary care physicians. There are not enough medical students choosing primary care. And there's a reason for that too, or reasons for that too. So there are follow-on challenges that have to be solved, but they are worth solving, because much like chronic poverty and hunger, you know, there are all kinds of other consequences of not dealing with the fundamental of making healthcare available to everybody.
One of the things about the pandemic, I find it really interesting when I sort of look at it from a, I would say a more sort of analytical approach rather than an emotional approach is, you know, we have every bit of data point to tell you that vaccines are safe, effective, they work, that you should get one, that getting one will keep you alive, and that it's free. And yet we still have 30% of the population that has, not only do they not want to get it, they're going to find any reason they can not to get it. Mm. And it's, some of it, I think, has to come down to a relationship that they don't have someone they trust helping them with care. And I'm just curious about your perspective on that.
First of all, never in my wildest dreams would I have imagined we could politicize a public health emergency. Never in my wildest dreams. I think there's a special place in hell for the people who saw this as an opportunity to do just that. Second, I think in the work we did, I co-chaired something called the COVID Collaborative starting more than a year ago, because there were many people in the medical professions, in the in public policy and political leadership, in education, in public health institutions and what have you, who were feeling a lack of leadership, but where we could discern consensus on a bunch of things, testing and tracking and tracing and so forth. And so we started to develop some consensus policies, for lack of a better term, and share them broadly. And we developed them with all of these marvelous collaborators. Once the Biden administration was elected, a bunch of them, like Rochelle Walensky, went into the administration. We concluded pretty early on that unless there was encouragement coming from a trusted source, it was going to be not counterproductive, it's just not going to matter. And those trusted sources varied from community to community. And so trying to identify who those were and empower them to speak up, giving them the accurate information so that they could, enormously important. This is well before anybody was talking about vaccine mandates or anything.
Right. When you looked into that data, what did you see difference between different cultures and different ethnicities?
We saw some of what has been widely reported in terms of Black communities feeling suspicious of the vaccine and its efficacy. In fairness, you know, the communication on that was pretty messy at the beginning. I'm smiling just because, you know, in the Life Sciences Initiative, which we'll talk about in a little bit, we gave a little grant, one of the early grants, to a little company called Moderna. Yeah. And look at them now. as you saw, and I wish I had the data right in front of me, but as you saw the politicalization of the pandemic grow, you also saw all kinds of communities, regardless of race or region, becoming skeptical of the vaccine because the first vaccine had been developed in response to the Trump administration's what's the program called?
Warp Speed.
And the view of some was, well, if he's backing it, it can't be trusted. Say what you will about whether he had earned that mistrust, it was a factor for some communities. I think we've been working our way back from that. That all of that stuff, the disinformation as well, ever since.
And I hope that one of the silver linings coming out of the pandemic is just a continued effort of the distribution of care, you know, care in communities, the sort of dislocation or, you know, dissemination of care out into communities.
Yep.
We see that, we talk about that from an industry standpoint across, you know, product development in different care settings. There's obviously a long, long way to go, but I think there's a lot of reason to be optimistic from an industry standpoint that there's a it's a big opportunity to deliver care, to deliver new products, to learn about issues that are probably not surfaced as quickly and as often as they need to be. So
I agree with that strongly. And I you know, you asked the question earlier, Matt, about are we going to remember what we learned from the pandemic?
Right.
Are we going to understand the disparities in health and the social impact on health of other social and economic disparities in our community? We have a famously short attention span in America. So and the racial disparities as well. So I hope so, because I think, frankly, distributed care, localized care is often higher quality care. It's also often less expensive care. And I think trying to innovate around that, try some things to experiment around that is something I continue to be interested in and involved in.
You've referred to your healthcare reform law that you implemented as governor as an expression of shared values and a belief that health is a public good. Mm-hmm. In the context of all this, do you think that Americans, the majority of Americans, believe that, you know, are compelled by that?
I want to believe that. I think they do. The ACA, if the polls are to be believed, at the national level is more popular today than it ever was. I think we had one advantage here that President Obama didn't have, and he and I've talked about this in the past. You know, we had this broad coalition of healthcare leaders and practitioners and workers and business people and legislators and patient advocates all come together to invent our reform, and then they stuck together to refine it as we went along, right? So we did two or three major healthcare reform bills after Governor Romney signed the first one, because everybody was invested in its success. The hardest one, by the way, being cost containment. And there, that was the most frustrating to me. But that's an advantage that President Obama never had, right? He had people on the other side who didn't want the American people to have universal health care, at least a plan that was devised by government, leaving aside the fact that that this particular model was created in a Republican leaning think tank, you know. But we're going to leave politics out of it.
Okay, we're going to leave it there and take a quick break. We'll be right back to talk more with Governor Deval Patrick about the Life Sciences Act of 2008.
Boyd Technologies is an advanced materials and technology company operating in the medical device and life sciences market. We're experts in regulated single-use devices and liquid media solutions. Our growth platform provides a full suite of services for design and development, advanced manufacturing, and fulfillment operations. To learn more, visit us at boydtech.com.
It's interesting to me, you know, as we go into talking about sort of the life sciences bill, how that worked in conjunction, you know, as you're implementing that, then you see also this major push towards innovating the healthcare ecosystem. Mm-hmm. I'm curious, did you learn lessons in one that you brought over to the other? Or?
Probably. I mean, We had a coalition who helped develop the Life Sciences Initiative, and we kept learning things about even in the development of the legislation. There were things we were learning from the experience in healthcare that we imported to how we thought about the Life Sciences Initiative. So, for example, we arrived at I hate to say this on the record, but we arrived at the $1 billion number kind of seat of the pants, because it was, you know, California had a $3 billion initiative, and we didn't think we could do that. The more important part of it for me was the 10-year commitment, because in this industry, you have to think and you have to think longer term. And government, in policy making anyway, has gotten out of the habit of thinking longer term. It's very much about the next, you know, election cycle or news cycle, and not the next generation. So the idea of having Massachusetts make a commitment to the industry that was durable and enduring was, I think, also supported by the experience we were having with healthcare reform. That's one. I think also having flexibility in the bill to deploy the available resources or talent as the industry needed and was changing. So, for example, I don't think government is in a position or ought to be in a position to substitute for the private sector. Some companies are going to make it, some not. And I don't happen to believe personally and from experience that, you know, tax incentives are going to make the difference between whether people do or don't invest in a great idea. It's a sweetener or a closer maybe, but it's not central. But sometimes what a company needed to expand here was, you know, subsurface infrastructure. They wanted to build a lab, Genzyme. They wanted to put a facility out in Framingham. They got all the local permitting, but Framingham didn't have any money to build the kind of waste system underground that would make it possible. Well, the Life Sciences Center had that money. They applied. They made the case. There were so many jobs. There was a clawback. If the jobs weren't producing, that made sense. There was a small pot of money for great ideas that, in the scientists' view, would perish in the so-called valley of death, you know, between concept and commercialization. A little bit of money would keep them going. And not the bureaucrats, not us, but the scientific panel would review these ideas and in a couple cases gave a small grant. I wish we'd taken equity in one of them called Moderna again. But that was a place where there was a market gap and government could fill it. And I think that kind of flexibility, I wish we'd had more of it in the healthcare reform bill, but we had some of it in the healthcare reform bill, and we had and the legislature had a sense that they could entrust that kind of flexibility to the administration. So I think that helped as well.
We're talking about politics and sort of the thinking in the long term. And I wanted to go back to this quote I have here from you. This is in a recent interview. You said, "We have to get to a place where we are permitting at the public policy level, just as we do in the private sector, a willingness to try new things. One of the things about innovation is that you also have to raise your tolerance for failure, and politics punishes failure."
Right.
So, I mean, as governor, how did you come to that decision about a long-term billion-dollar investment in life sciences, which is now, 14 years ago?
Remember, this was in the depths of the Great Recession, and I remember soon after the recession had been formally declared. I don't remember what all the conditions are, but that we were nationally in a serious recession. I had a group called the Governor's Council of Economic Advisors, and we had a meeting, and they said, "Governor, we feel you should know that historically Massachusetts has gone into recession deeper and stayed longer than the rest of the country." I said, "Okay, now what?" And they said, "Well, we just thought you should know."
Thank you for that.
So I'm just not content by nature, and I wasn't in office to just, you know, let the future happen. I believed, and I often talked about how we could shape our own future. We had to have a strategy to grow out of that. And some of it was, you know, it had short, medium, and long-term features, but I'd talk about it around the Commonwealth and around the world as being about investing in education, innovation, and infrastructure. And in the case of the life sciences, it was sort of prototypical, right? Because we have this ridiculous concentration of brain power within an hour of downtown Boston. 200 universities or colleges, research institutions, teaching hospitals. We had all that. And as I was saying before, the camera started rolling, what we didn't have or didn't have well developed was the collaborative gene. And again, I would say this to folks, if we could figure out how to pull all that together and use it as a foundation for growth, what are the industries that depend on that kind of concentration of brain power? Well, we had a life sciences community. It was, California was trying to take it, such as it was, but it needed some. Part of what it needed was the legislation, but the other part of what it needed was some celebration, some encouragement, some championing. We had to talk about it and embrace it as an industry and a possibility here. And every once in a while, behind closed doors, you'd have to scold it too about how, we have talent in the South Coast and in the central and western part of the state too. And that then prompts other things, right? Well, that would work if we had different transportation infrastructure. We need housing opportunity. Do you understand what I'm saying? It's all interconnected. So I think though, to your point about taking a chance, we had a very powerful and effective, not quite as expensive initiative around clean energy as well. And the first grant that we made in clean energy was to a solar panel developer in Devens.
Yeah.
And we didn't lose any money, but we didn't make a lot of money, and they ended up in China. And that was all over the news. And yet one of the three fastest growing industries to bring us out of recession was the clean tech sector. Nobody knows. Right. So you understand my point?
Yeah.
You have to be willing to try stuff. And by that, I don't mean just that the elected official or officials have to be willing to try stuff. The public has to get in a kind of a mojo that we are going to try some things. Not everything's going to be perfect, but we're going to try some things. We're going to iterate because we know where we're going. And that brings me to the last point. I think we have to talk all the time, and our leadership has to talk all the time about where we're going. I think people will support mistakes, within a band, if you're really clear that this is in service of a destination, which is a good for all of us, and not just, another bragging point for the elected official.
All the ingredients were here. The last thing was government getting involved and getting behind the life sciences industry. And if you look at today, what'd you say, 14 years later?
Yeah, right.
We
almost
are probably in the global epicenter of health technology. And I wonder, do you think back on that and look at it as a direct line and say, I was part of that? Feel pretty good about that?
I feel really great about that. I was only part of it. We had a lot of people, other people in the public sector, lots of colleagues in the private sector and in the academy as well. I think the thing to bear in mind, and this may be the sort of thing that anybody from South Side of Chicago would say, is that it could be gone like that. And there are things you have to do to cultivate and grow it, right? We have a little apartment in Kendall Square now. Feels very hip, and I mean, we're living in a place where when I was in college, you would not have gone into.
No.
And I see all the cranes and I see the lab space going up. That lab space is wicked expensive. The manufacturing of the inventions that come out of Kendall Square still, I think, disproportionately go elsewhere rather than to the South Coast or Merrimack Valley or the Berkshires. We haven't quite put all the features together, and we can have this and have it expand beyond the greater Boston area, practically expand, not reputationally, because it's hard to imagine the reputation would be bigger. But we have to be intentional about that, and that's not going to be on any one sector to do.
I'm glad you mentioned manufacturing, because I think one of the things that's really, you know, we're a small manufacturer, but I think one of the things that is so compelling to think about for me is, you know, the period between 2005 and 10, 11, 12 was a devastating period for small manufacturers in America. It was a bad period for manufacturing kind of writ large, but for small manufacturers, it was really devastating. And this bill went into place in 2008. You know, we went through the economic crisis, and now here we are in this booming industry. And I can say we've chosen to focus on this industry as a mm-hmm. business, but, we're a small supplier in the western part of the state. Mm-hmm. And to me, it is really evidence of how an ecosystem like this feeds, a broader geography, a broader set of businesses. I think we're having success there, but it's fragile, as you said. So what do we need to do?
Well, I don't know whether this is still the case, but once upon a time, when it was time to commercialize an idea that was ready and coming out of Kendall Square, folks would compare the cost of manufacturing in Cambridge to the cost of manufacturing in Bangalore. And I would say, how about comparing it to the cost of manufacturing in New Bedford or Pittsfield? And sometimes they would, but sometimes they did. I shouldn't say it never happened, but the South Coast Rail would have made a huge difference in answer to that. The rail, the improvement of the rail service and the schedule between Boston and Worcester had a huge impact on Worcester participating in this industry. And the same is true or would be true of the Berkshires, notwithstanding the fact that, the economic orientation, this, Matt, is more north-south in the Berkshires than it is east-west. People look more to New York or north to, Vermont and Canada, but they do because that's how you get from place to place. Those are the ways available to get from place to place. It's not just the train. It's a mindset about the whole Commonwealth being a part of this ecosystem. That could well be regional in nature, but this ought to be this Commonwealth, not just this city. Ought to be, or this greater Boston area should be the, and can be the hub of it. And when you think further about the pressures on affordable housing and the need for talent to keep up with the growth, then you have to push the ecosystem out from, out beyond Boston.
The amazing part about having a chance to look at this from this vantage point of all these years later is it worked really well. It worked almost too well in some respects, and that we have all this opportunity and we built it. They're here. Do we actually now have the infrastructure to serve it? And did you guys think about that at all?
You bet your life we did.
Yeah.
One of the things that happens in policy making is a lot of it happens in silos when citizens don't live their lives in silos. You land at Logan, you take the shuttle to downtown, you take the train from South Station to some western suburb, and you pick up your car in the parking lot and you drive home. You're not thinking about which department is responsible for which part of that trip. You just want it to be smooth and safe and convenient, right? And modern. And I think if you think about it that way, from the citizen's perspective, then the interconnection between hard infrastructure, housing costs, family supports, recreation, and the stuff that folks who work in the industry like to do, all of that is of a piece. Where are the other universities and research institutions and hospitals? Where are they now, and where could they be? When they're thinking about, where is broadband? The one of the intersection of two of the fastest broadband systems on the planet is underneath Route 90 and Route 91, I-90 and I-91. So why don't we have more stuff happening in Springfield and around Springfield? You got to bring the other pieces to bear. So we tried in some other, we had a huge infrastructure push at the end. We tried a couple times. And the first time went down in flames because we were proposing to increase the gas tax. And then we tried again, and the legislative leadership said, bring us anything but a gas tax. And I said, okay. So we sold it in. The polls were in our favor, and then they decided they wanted to do a gas tax, which was not going to get it all done. So it's a journey.
We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back to talk more with Governor Deval Patrick about workforce, diversity, and inclusivity in the life sciences industry.
For more than a quarter of a century, MassMedic has been the voice of the groundbreaking medical technology industry in New England, advocating for sound public policy that supports innovation and fostering a community built on a shared purpose, saving and improving the lives of patients everywhere through medical technology. Since the beginnings of New England's dominance in health tech, our members, the women and men who make up MassMedic, are researching, designing, developing, supplying, manufacturing, and deploying the next generation of medical innovations around the globe. The heart of health tech beats here in Massachusetts. And at MassMedic, we're proud to be part of that journey. Learn more about how you can join our community at massmedic.com.
You know, this has been an incredible period of growth and expansion in the industry. It's also been very clear that this has not benefited everyone equally. Right. And I think, you know, inclusivity and workforce are to me, one and the same. Mm-hmm. I want to read you another quote.
Oh, boy.
Which I think is really
interesting.
I have an
answer for all my... comments.
I think this is the same interview. You said, I think we've made our uneasy peace with non-discrimination laws. We've never really made our peace with integration. Mm-hmm. We haven't made our peace with living and working and playing and loving together. There's no question that the life sciences industry needs to be more inclusive before it can be more diverse. Mm. So how do we be more inclusive? And, you know, I think this all goes back to this workforce question for me of... we need a talented, larger, growing workforce.
Yep.
How do we become more inclusive?
You know, it's always blown my mind that one of the fastest growing industries in our Commonwealth is walking distance or a short subway ride from Roxbury. And yet there are not a whole lot of folks in the industry from Roxbury. Now, I don't think the answer to that is that there's a disproportionately small number of Roxbury residents, of black people who don't have PhDs, because most of the people who work in the industry don't have PhDs. But there is a pipeline problem. And we did some work on that with Roxbury Community College and with Bunker Hill Community College in a program I think was called... Earn and Learn, or Learn and Earn, where you had an internship, you had a job while you were getting industry-specific skills. There was a big, big push, which I think has continued, around STEM education. Some of what has to happen is that people have to just be exposed to the life sciences industry. They have to know what that is, you know? And if, I can imagine any number of young people being dazzled by working here. You know, it's light, it's fun, it's airy, you don't have a tie on. but they don't, you know, they have to be able to imagine what that might be like. And there were some, Vertex has done some of this work, and a couple of others, I should remember some names, are bringing people in and giving them internship opportunities or mentorship opportunities, just so they could walk around and be exposed to what it might be like to work in one of these companies, and frankly, I think that's good for everybody. You know, it's good for the interest of long-term workforce development. But it's also good for the kid, you know, the black kid from Roxbury. I'm being sort of prototypical, I hope you know, but to go and work in an environment that of all the workforces here in the Commonwealth is one of the most international.
Right.
Right? People from all over the place. And when you get right down to it, they're trying to solve a problem that improves humankind. I mean, that's the nature of it. And that's pretty inspiring stuff.
One of the most interesting things we do as a company is bring customers to our manufacturing facility where they demonstrate and describe and showcase their products, how our product is used in their product, if it's a component or if we're making the product, how it's used with a patient. And that connection to the mission, to the patient, it's everything. And we never have a better day of productivity than the day after we do that.
I'm telling you, but I think we're all hungry for meaning.
Yeah.
We all are. And you bring that to your work, you show its connection to, you know, to the end service. I just think it's important. It's a human thing.
The life sciences industry sometimes, I think, mistakes itself for being diverse because it's international.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, do you think we need a $1 billion life sciences act for workforce right now?
Well, we need a lot for workforce now, and it's a lot more than $1 billion. I don't know that I don't know that it needs to be. I mean, you're asking me a question about how to meet the needs of the life sciences industry, and I totally get that. I don't know how to scale that. I don't know. Couldn't tell you if it's $1 billion or something, but it needs focus. But the skill set for many of the jobs in the life sciences is the same skill set that has to be cultivated for lots of other jobs in our economy here and elsewhere in the country. And that's not going to happen by accident. It's also not going to be it's not going to happen by training alone. Some of it has to be exposure.
You know, when I look at the numbers from the Bureau of Labor and Statistics, with black participation tends to be the folks driving the MBTA buses, taking people to these jobs. Mm-hmm. And where can we do a better job in terms of, like, we have to get into the community. Is there entry points that we're missing?
I sit on the boards of two life sciences companies, the CEOs of both of which are black men. And they are very intentional about making internships available, about having, of the senior leadership team were charged with finding black interns. He was very specific about black interns to bring in the summer. And while they were there, to figure out who could be hired in full time and what a career path for them would be. It's small steps, but they are examples of, and there's power in the example. In the other, this is a company working in sickle cell disease, where most of the patient population is black, and how to deliver what is now a commercially ready and distributed therapy in a way that actually reaches the patients who are in many cases dealing with the cultural insensitivities of their caregivers has been a major business challenge, but he's taken it on and he's brought in other black professionals to help with that, who kind of get it or who are able to help others get it. What he doesn't do, and what I hope he will do, is lift that up as an example. It's another way to expose people to what the industry is about, because it's not just about supply and it's not just about demand. It's a little of both.
Do you think in the last, all that has gone on in the last 2 years, that corporate America have we crossed over a milestone of diversity and inclusivity in terms of the commitment and the sustained commitment to it?
I hope so. I remember right after Barack Obama was elected president, how much commentary there was in the media about how we were now in a post-racial society. And it was sweet, but it was not realistic. And anybody who was wondering about that should stop wondering after watching that horrific video of George Floyd's killing. But as I said earlier, you know, we are famously short in our attention span in this country. This is, you know, this issue of how to have an inclusive, a successful, inclusive, multiracial, multiethnic democracy, that's been a challenge since our founding. And in fits and starts, we've made progress. And we have, over time, made more progress than we have not. So for those who say, you know, nothing's changed, I reject that. It's just not true. A lot of that change has happened in my own lifetime. But part of the genius of the country, I think, is that the founding principles beckon us to keep at it. You know, you can't be about equality, opportunity, and fair play for all, right? The ingredients of freedom. You can't be about that without dealing with the question of who gets to build a better life for him or herself and their family, and who doesn't. And so I'm encouraged by the agita right now. I obviously want it to be peaceful. I want it to be constructive. I want us to bring along the people who are still resistant and not just, you know, plow them under, because it is still a community and we all have a place in it. But I think the closer we get and the more energy we bring to closing the gap between our reality and our ideals, the stronger we are and the more powerful, frankly, we are at home and abroad.
Do you when you think back to your time in public service here, and if you, I mean, I hope you have more in you.
Oh, mercy.
But do you think of yourself as a healthcare leader?
I think that the challenges that face us all are too big today for any one sector to solve. They're too big for government. They're too big alone, that is. Too big for government alone, too big for business alone, too big for not-for-profits alone, and that there is real power in collaboration. I think that if I have a talent, is that I really thrive on that. It's exciting for me, and I'm pretty good at getting people to come together and work toward, you know, practical and lasting, I hope, solutions. So if that's healthcare or education or clean tech or whatever it is, I hope in whatever capacity I have an opportunity to offer that.
Well, I'll tell you this. You can't put your name on the tunnel, but if we had a life sciences in Massachusetts tunnel, your name would be on it.
Well, that's very kind. That's very kind. I hope it's a more, you know, emblematic structure than a tunnel. Maybe a bridge.
Yeah. Well, I want to thank you for what you've done for this industry. I had a chance to watch it. I've had a chance to have an up close personal seat of these last 14 years, and I can say that what you started, and that spark and that celebration that you brought to it mattered, made a big difference in this industry. And I think your legacy in Massachusetts is one of a dynamic and energetic healthcare leader who really sparked something quite majestic.
Thank you.
As a Western Massachusetts, you know, Berkshire County manufacturer, I'm not sure we would be here without the industry that we serve today, which I do. I am comfortable saying I think it has a lot to thank you for. So
appreciate that, Matt. Thank you.
Thank you. And I think we're going to leave it there. Thank you for your time today.
You bet. You bet. Please edit it gently.
Yes.
And don't forget the James Earl Jones dubbing. Okay.